From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, May 15th, 2018. And on this day, do Mainers understand ranked choice voting? And the Maine Department of Environmental Protection hears from kids who are worried about climate change. That's ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Norway Savings, supporting the colorful vision of Maine's business owners. Live your life in color. NorwaySavings.bank.
Maine's highest court heard oral arguments today that could decide whether a Portland landlord should be jailed for violating codes at an apartment house he owned where six people were killed in a fire in 2014. Fred Bever has details.
Lawyer Luke Rio argued for vacating Gregory Nisbet's conviction and 90-day jail sentence on a misdemeanor code violation. Rio maintains that the state's code requirement for window size was unconstitutionally ambiguous. And he argued that state prosecutors failed to properly enter the code into evidence during trial, drawing some sharp questioning from Justice Joseph Jabber.
The state's expert witnesses and the defense expert witnesses were not aware of it, yet Mr. Nisbet is being sent to jail for knowingly violating
but
this.
But if nobody was aware of it, how can you say the state suppressed it?
Well, their witnesses were in possession of it and turned it over
and
to the prosecutor.
As soon as they found out about it, you were told about it. As soon as the state found out about it through the witness, they gave it to you.
Assistant Attorney General Donald Macomber told the court that all evidence demonstrated that the third floor windows were too small to allow for a direct escape from the fire, and that Nisbet, who had been warned about the question, was criminally responsible for the deaths of six people. While the court considers its decision, Nisbet, who says he is now indigent, remains free on bail. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Maine voters in next month's state primary will be the first to use ranked choice voting for state elections. Election experts say many voters don't understand how ranked choice voting works, but they are hopeful that the voter education programs going on now can help clear up any confusion. Mel Leary has our story.
There have been a lot of news stories about legal challenges to ranked choice voting and a legislative move to suspend its use. But are Maine voters aware of how to use it when they go to their polling places on Election Day?
I suspect a fair amount of voters in June are going to show up without a full idea of what they're doing for ranked choice voting.
University of Maine poli-sci professor Mark Brewer is cautious, but sees how next month's election could be a good test run.
I don't think it'll be as bad in June as it would be in November, because, again, it's a primary and it's the more attentive voters. And
Brewer says that's why it's important a slew of public service messages and other education efforts are underway. Jim Melcher, who teaches politics at the University of Maine at Farmington campus, agrees.
I think even a lot of relatively educated voters are still trying to figure out the ranked choice voting system. At the college where I teach, a lot of very bright people are saying, oh, could you explain some more of this to me?
Melcher says Republicans are challenging ranked choice voting as a party, and that may affect Republicans using the system in the primary election for governor. Democratic Secretary of State Matt Dunlap has launched a voter education campaign that includes several forums around the state, a web page devoted to explaining how it works, and a 5-minute web video. Dunlap says more politically aware voters understand how to use ranked choice voting. But, he says, less engaged voters could be confused when they see it for the first time.
Here you are working with someone who may have just worked a double shift, and they're walking to the polling station at 8:05 on election night, and they've never seen this before. Everything we do in elections is predicated towards helping that voter.
Dunlap says that includes materials explaining the system the voter can read as they cast their first votes using the ranking system. Advocates of ranked choice voting say once voters have used the new system, they will see how easy it is to use. But supporters realize the need to educate voters, particularly for this first election. Several groups are using different strategies, including a direct mail campaign sent to hundreds of thousands of voters, a speaker's bureau giving speeches and presentations across the state, and TV ads costing hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Ranked choice voting gives you the power to rank as many or as few candidates as you like, from your first choice to your second choice to your third choice and so on.
Kyle Bailey, campaign manager for the Committee for Ranked Choice Voting, says adopting the new voting system is a major change in the way Mainers elect candidates.
The Committee for Ranked Choice Voting and our allied organizations and others who are part of a broad coalition that are interested in making sure voters are engaged and informed and participatory in the political process obviously are making sure those tools are available to voters and assisting with voter education.
But political scientist Brewer emphasizes most Mainers won't focus on the primaries until next month, and some not until they go to the polls. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
The Maine Department of Environmental Protection got an earful today from a group of high school and middle school students worried about climate change. The students are asking the DEP to take steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Today's public hearing was prompted by a petition they filed earlier this year about what they say is the state's failure to do its part to protect them. Patty White reports.
There are elements to the school day that can feel dire for any student. For 14-year-old Devin Shaughnessy of Portland, it's when she learns about climate change in science class. She spoke about that as she waited for her turn to testify.
It's kind of sounding like a death sentence. Like, it's talking about this, like, inevitable world ending because of what we're doing. And there's nothing that we as kids can do about it. It's up to the adults. And it's frustrating because the adults are not doing much about it because they won't be here. It's like it'll be our problem.
It's a problem that Shaughnessy and other students recently decided that they can do something about. Backed by local and international environmental groups, they're petitioning the Maine Department of Environmental Protection to take stronger action to battle climate change. Specifically, they want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by at least 8% a year. That would bring emissions in Maine to 75% below 2003 levels by 2035.
I feel that action has to be taken really before it's too late, and at this rate, we don't have much time left.
14-year-old Lance Danino of Kennebunk gets that sense of urgency from what he witnesses, stronger storms that are causing more environmental damage. The state has taken action on climate change. 15 years ago, the state adopted a law that set goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2010. A biennial report from the DEP earlier this year found that Maine met that target and is on track to meet the next target of reducing emissions even further by 2020. But Ruth Metcalf of Kennebunkport says that's not enough.
They set their promise to us 15 years ago when they said they were going to change. And I'm 15, so I was born in 2003. So in my lifetime, it should have gotten better by now, but it hasn't. It's gotten a lot worse.
But some at the hearing think the proposals laid out in the petition go too far.
We're speaking today on behalf of a group of clients who are among the largest manufacturers in the state.
Lisa Gilbreth is an attorney at Pierce Atwood in Portland. She says these companies aren't opposed to reducing emissions further.
Instead, we are opposed to these proposals because they're simply impractical.
Gilbreth says the proposals would make Maine an outlier from other states, putting manufacturing companies at a competitive disadvantage. But 12-year-old Asfia Jawadi of Portland says she thinks Maine should be a leader on fighting climate change.
So maybe if Maine could like start getting like less carbon emissions, we could like help the world see that it can be, they can do it, and like we could expand it so we could become carbon free.
In Oregon, another group of kids has filed a lawsuit arguing that the federal government's failure to take action on climate change is violating their constitutional rights. A federal court just rejected an attempt by the Trump administration to block the lawsuit from moving forward. It's scheduled for trial in district court in October. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
A new law took effect on May 1st that changes the language used to describe substance use in Maine's laws. The law seeks to do a small part of the work that's required to deal with the state's opioid crisis by moving toward destigmatizing the way we describe it. So, for example, the law removes references to terms like alcohol and drug abuse and replaces that with substance use disorder. Rather than saying alcoholic or drug addict, somebody will be described as a person with substance use disorder. It's a small step, but one that people who work in the recovery field say is important. Katie Fulham-Harris is Senior Vice President of Government Relations at Maine Health. She served on the legislature's opioid task force, and her organization testified in favor of the bill. Katie, one of the responses I have heard to this is, why does it matter if it's just language? How do you respond to that?
As someone who works in the medical field, I see the stigma attached to addiction and people with substance use disorder pervasive throughout medical professionals as well as society as a whole. When we start to change the language that we use, we start to make it okay to talk about. We start to think about substance use disorder differently, and we start to think about it as being part of a regimen of healthcare diagnoses that are among many, many diagnoses that can be effectively treated. We've talked about this in the behavioral health field around mental illness, around substance use disorder services for many years, and we know that it truly makes a difference when you start to talk about it differently.
How does this new law fit in with the larger recommendations from the task force?
This law is a step among a whole number of recommendations that the task force made. This was a nice step in that it didn't have a cost attached to it. It was simply having our government and our laws and rules reflect state-of-the-art thinking related to substance use disorder and addressing substance use disorder as a chronic disease. The other recommendations made by the task force, and there were a number of recommendations, but many of them represented the need for treatment, the need for prevention services, and several of those remain on the legislature's docket, unfinished business at this point in time.
What are the next steps then to dealing with the crisis from your perspective?
It is absolutely critical that we as a state provide the resources and develop the service capacity necessary to ensure that we're meeting the needs of people with opioid use disorder and other substance use disorders where they are. We as a state really need to step forth and develop a robust system of services that ensures that everyone with substance use disorder has access to treatment when and where they need it. At this point in time, we are far cry from that, and we have a bill, LD 1430, is sitting on the appropriations table that would take some important steps to providing substance use disorder treatment for individuals with opioid use disorder in the state. They would have access to acute services when they need them, and as well as services as they start to recover and step down and need fewer medical services, may need more social types of supports. So this bill really reflects the need for the social determinants of health, as we say in the lingo, but things like vocational services, things like access to housing, and other services that are so important for an individual's recovery.
Katie Fulham-Harris is Senior Vice President of Government Relations at MaineHealth, and she served on the Opioid Task Force in Augusta. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, May 15th, 2018. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.